around 8:30 p.m. Baghdad time, United States military forces captured Saddam Hussein alive. He was found near a farmhouse outside the city of Tikrit in a swift raid conducted without casualties. And now the former dictator of Iraq will face the justice he denied to millions. The capture of this man was crucial to the rise of a free Iraq. It marks the end of the road for him and for all who bullied and killed in his name. For the Ba'athist holdouts, largely responsible for the current violence, there will be no return to the corrupt power and privilege they once held. For the vast majority of Iraqi citizens who wish to live as free men and women, this event brings further assurance that the torture chambers and the secret police are gone forever. And this afternoon, I have a message for the Iraqi people.
Eileen?
You will not have to fear the rule of Saddam Hussein ever again. All Iraqis who take the side of freedom have taken the winning side. The goals of our coalition are the same as your goals. Sovereignty for your country.
Shut the hell up, Boy George. This nonsense about you, the Iraqi people, will not have to fear the rule of Saddam Hussein ever again. Yeah, right. Just the rule of DynCorp, Bechtel, U.S. dollarism, and corporate capital free market, imperial control. In other words, Yankee occupation. Then you have the nerve to babble out to the Iraqi people. This marks the end of the torture chambers and secret police. What the hell are you talking about? You just turned Hussein over to the CIA. And guess what they're going to be doing? And then you also have the nerve to babble out Hussein will face the justice he denied to millions. Well, I guess that puts him in the same category as Sam, as Sam has also denied justice to millions of people throughout the world in Chile, Colombia, Venezuela, Angola, Guantanamo Bay, the Palestinian people, Amadou Diallo. Well, you get the point. You know what time it is. Slaves time. Check this out. You're listening to 104.1, 96.3, Santa Cruz, 106.7, Illinois, LUVER.com, the world, slave revolt time. Tonight we're going to shoot our way into another form of weapons of mass distortion as we deal with how various sectors, from Michael Krasny to Bill O'Reilly, are basically in the same game and in the same gang within the shadows. And then we'll take off on a shameless file and on Sam's plantation piece. So we got all that in a hell of a lot more on 104.1 Slave Revolt Radio.
America, America, God shed his grace on thee and crowned thy good with the brotherhood of a select group of liars, cheaters, and thieves who used that brotherhood to form the most arbitrary and ambiguous history the world has come to know. Red, white, and blue, the symbolism of hypocrisy and bureaucratic stagnation. Men of power, glossing the fault line cracks. In historical facts, red, white, and blue, those stars and stripes for never. Never again will I take a back seat, genuflect those my equal, sing that whining anthem or tatter my clothing with those tired ass colors. Blue. Blue is the mood that sweeps my emotions into a disastrousness of color me sad. Color me gray, color me gloomy when thinking of those colors, patriotic white. White are the ghost-faced pointed hoods swinging my ancestor from the tree that fed life back into earth to breed in abundance the fork-tongued serpent, erecting sacrilegious torches in the face of the phoenix who takes flight up out of the ash, leaving that glow in its dust, its winged fan spreading a shadow over hatred. And I see red. Red are my bloodshot eyes streaming tears down that flag shrouded in glory, glory, hallelujah. My country, 'tis of thee, waving embers across purple mountains majestic only to those who believe. While in the sky, atmospheric radiation beams down, singeing surf and turf, blistering the feet of the unprepared, running, running, running from those poisonous rays, seeking to alleviate your pain, taking your face with Sunblock 2000, covering up your face, covering up your skin, covering up your history of bad blood and foul misinterpretations. Running from each other, running out of the frying pan and into the fiery douses of hell, and forever will you burn with those crosses of iniquity, and let those you've abused inherit your precious earth. So fly your flag in hell, still streaming down its acts of change and cover-up that have insistently been deemed necessary. And I will cry. Cry social injustice. Cry racism. Cry sacrilege. Cry freedom from sea to shining sea. My tears will not provide you with escape. And you, your pointed hoods and your smoking crosses shall burn forever, marching in the parade of hell's fire and brimstone.
Attention, seekers everywhere. I was right. Everything I knew was wrong.
The right-wing hack on Fox News who does the O'Reilly Factor, and he likes to claim that his show is a no-spin zone, and he also likes to present himself as someone who stands above or away from being classified as either left or right. We'll deal with that as we go on. But what's also fascinating is he spends a lot of his time attacking KQED, not for reasons that it should be attacked, but because he basically poses that KQED is some kind of left liberal bastion. And what's fascinating is that Michael Krasny, who is the host of a show called Forum on KQED on Monday through Friday, he is often perceived as someone of the liberal slash progressive persuasion. Well, on our Beyond the Shadow piece, let's put that a little bit to the test. As just about everyone knows or should know, Saddam Hussein was captured. And as you heard me blow up Boy George in the beginning of the show as he was squawking about the capture, now many questions have been raised about what is going to happen. Let's first explore the quote-unquote liberal, Michael Krasny, on his KQED forum show, as he asks Abraham Socure from the Hoover Institute, who will try Saddam Hussein? So let's check out what these two have to say, and then we'll take it from there. Check this out.
Exclusive, brutal dictator represents a symbolic moment of great historic weight, even though the violence of the so-called insurgency continues. In fact, we spoke before with the author of a book on, actually it was captured on Saturday, and we spoke earlier, as you may recall, at the beginning of the last hour with the author of a book on the Middle East, and we wanted to talk this hour about what this recent, rather historic event means. We had scheduled an hour with a distinguished military historian, Williamson Murray, who is co-author of A War to Be Won, Fighting the Second World War, and principal author of the Operations Volume of the Gulf War Air Power Survey, and co-authored his most recent book, which was published by Harvard Press, with Major General Robert Scales, called The Iraq War, A Military History, and he's going to be joining us for the hour. We wanted first off, though, to talk a little bit about what the capture of Saddam Hussein means in terms of justice, really, and Abraham Sofer is going to join us briefly as George P. Schultz, distinguished scholar and senior fellow at the Hoover Institution, former legal counsel to the State Department from 1985 to 1990, and Professor Sofer, glad to have you here. Good morning.
Good morning, Michael.
The question on many people's minds is, who's going to try Saddam Hussein? And your thoughts about that?
Well, they already have adopted, the governing council has adopted with our approval, a process for trying war criminals. The governing council is not a sovereign body. So long as it has the approval of the coalition authority, which is the occupying power and therefore has the right to exercise sovereign powers, it can try Saddam. But thinking ahead, the president has issued an order, which is now part of an agreement between the governing council and the provisional authority, that sovereignty pass in June of 2004 to the new Iraqi interim government that we hope will be in place. And so it will be the interim government that probably will be trying Saddam Hussein.
Now, what's fascinating about the start of this Krasny show is that basically there's basically an acceptance of how the U.S. went in there. There's no challenge to the authority. Now, we know that the real challenge comes down to gunfire in the real world, but I'm talking about the so-called moral authority that the U.S. is trying to pretend that it has. And by talking all of this regime change and all of this type of stuff, it's really smoke and mirrors. And here you have someone like Krasny, who's supposed to be, quote unquote, somewhat skeptical of those in political power of the Boy George persuasion. He basically says the particular lines you would expect Michael Savage or Bill O'Reilly to say. He talks about Saddam being the elusive, brutal dictator, which of course he was, but most of Saddam's career as a brutal dictator was under the umbrella of the U.S. Empire, and they didn't have a problem with him being that brutal Frankenstein monster dictator then, because he was basically in remote control for what they wanted. So then this other guy, Socure, talks about the governing council would try Saddam with Sam's approval. And once again, this is no challenge from Krasny again. An acceptance of what's going on. And we've seen these things take place before. basically the Pakistanians have, you know, their military intelligence, the ISI, and that has to get the U.S. Empire's approval of who will be the head of it. So here Pakistan, a sovereign nation, has to get the approval of the U.S. Empire for who's the head of their ISI. And the ISI, in cahoots with the CIA, have been involved in creating these terrorist networks like the Mujahideen and Osama and all of these characters. So the fact that the U.S. is now putting some other fraction together that has to get its approval, with his track record, you would think if things are supposed to be more or less true about Krasny, and in reality they are, he is a liberal, and being a typical liberal, he does not have really a problem with the status quo of the society. But the problem, and how we're going to address some of these issues, is that the image projected about him versus Bill O'Reilly, you would expect them, quote unquote, to be on the opposite side of the fence. But in reality, they're on the same side of the fence.
Yeah, I just wanted to add, whenever you hear somebody say that Saddam was a dictator or brutal this or brutal, put your hand over your pocket, y'all. Put your hand over your pocket. What the hell are they worrying about some brutal... Every country in the world, man, brutality is the rule. And the United States calls these people allies. And in fact, Saddam was an ally. The genocide duo, that is, Saddam and Rumsfeld, actually met in Baghdad. Donald H. Rumsfeld went to Baghdad on March of 1984 with instructions to deliver a private message about weapons of mass destruction. And that message was that the United States public criticism of Iraq for using chemical weapons would not derail Washington's attempts to forge a better relationship, according to newly classified documents.
Now, next up, Krasny asked Sokar about how the trial could be very important and informative to the world. Now, let's see what their version of informative really means. Check this out.
One would assume this is an important trial, particularly in terms of the presentation of evidence of what this regime did in the way of torture and murder, and that that would all come out, and would all come out in a way that would be quite educational for the world to see.
I doubt all of it will come out, but they will focus on whoever the prosecutors are, will draw up an indictment of some kind, and it will be reminiscent of Nuremberg or of the Milosevic trial that's going on now in The Hague. And I think it would be an extremely gripping and important trial.
Is there any possibility that there could be, I mean, we think about American jurisprudence, we often think about deals, that is, with mass murderers. You tell us the information we need to know or want to know, and this could apply to the so-called insurgency as well, and we'll not execute you. I mean, is there any possibility that kind of bargaining might go on in this case?
You know, it's hard for me as a prosecutor, a former prosecutor and a former defense lawyer, to think that it is always impossible, that it's ever impossible to have some kind of a deal. I don't think the U.S. is looking to cut a deal with Saddam. However, it is possible that the Iraqi government might forego, let us say, capital punishment for Saddam in exchange for very important information, let us say, about weapons of mass destruction or other important matters. So it is possible, but very, very unlikely.
All right, now once again, you see this whole bit about Krasny asking could they cut a deal possibly with Saddam, meaning the U.S. Empire, and how this is could be extremely gripping and important. But you didn't hear him ask about any of the historical connections. It's just an acceptance. Now, part of the reason why I'm dealing with some of that aspect is that there seems to be a little bit of confusion about just how vile the U.S. invasion into Iraq really was. Now, what I'm going to do is, see, when Boy George and them made their quote-unquote case for war in a letter to the Security Council delivered to the U.S. ambassador of the United Nations, This was in 2003 on March 20th. Now, I'm going to read to you the entire context of what that letter said. It was signed by John Negroponte, who's another a criminal, a convicted one at that. But nevertheless, let's go into this, and you'll see what they actually submitted as their justification to going into Iraq. It states, quote, Excellency, coalition's forces have commended military operations in Iraq. These operations are necessary in view of Iraq's continued material breaches of its disarmament obligations under relevant Security Council resolutions, including 1441. The operations are substantial and will secure compliance in those obligations. In carrying out these operations, these forces will take all necessary precautions to avoid civilian casualties. The actions being taken are authorized under existing council resolutions, including Resolution 678 and Resolution 687. Resolution 687 imposed a series of obligations on Iraq, including most important extensive disarmament obligations that were conditions of ceasefire established under it. It has long been recognized and understood that a material breach of these obligations removes the basis of ceasefire and revives the authority to use force under Resolution 678. This has been the basis for coalition's use of force in the past and has been accepted by the Council as evidence, for example, by the Security General public announcement in January 1993 following Iraq's material breach of Resolution 687 that coalition forces have received a mandate from the Council to use force according to Resolution 678. Iraq continues to be in material breach of its disarmament obligations under Resolution 687 as the Council affirmed in Resolution 1441. Acting under the authority of Chapter 12 of the UN Charter, the Council unanimously decided that Iraq has been and remain in material breach of its obligations and recalled its repeated warnings to Iraq that it will face serious consequences as a result of its continued violations of its obligation. The resolutions then provided Iraq a, quote, final opportunity, unquote, to comply, but stated specifically that violations by Iraq of its obligations under Resolutions 1441 to present a currently accurate, full, and complete declaration of all aspects of its weapons of mass destruction programs and to comply with and cooperate fully in the resolution's implications would constitute a further material breach. The government of Iraq decided not to avail itself of its final opportunity under Resolution 1441 and has clearly committed additional violations. In view of Iraq's material breaches, the basis for the ceasefire has been removed and the use of force is authorized under Resolution 678. Iraq repeatedly has refused over a protracted period of time to respond to diplomatic overtures, economic sanctions, and other peaceful means designed to bring about Iraqis' compliance with the obligation to disarm and to permit full inspection of weapons of mass destruction and related programs. The actions that coalition forces are undertaking are an appropriate response. They are necessary steps to defend the United States and the international community from the threat posed by Iraq and to restore international peace and security in the area. Further delay would simply allow Iraq to continue its unlawful and threatening conduct. It is the government of Iraq that bears full responsibility for the serious consequences of its defiance and of Council's decision. I would be grateful if you could circulate the text of this letter as a document of the Security Council. Sincerely, John D. Negroponte. That's the full statement given by the U.S. Empire to the Security Council for its justification. Now, what's fascinating is that one of the things that, and I read the whole text intentionally, you never heard them mention liberation or regime change in their statement to the Security Council. And that's because there's no standing under international law set forth in the Charter of the United States to justify you going into someone's country under the banner of liberating them or regime change. Now, the other thing you heard was that Negroponte also brought up Resolution 678, and he did so repeatedly, and with a lot of authority. But this is the smoke and mirrors game, because once again, while Resolution 678 does authorize the international community to use military force against Iraq, but that was only to liberate Kuwait, which was invaded in August of 1990. Resolution 678 provided the legal justification for Operation Desert Storm in early 1991. It does not in any way give any legitimacy for the military action against Iraq currently, or how it connects with the, or in its connection with Resolution 687. So this is someone who's intentionally playing smoke and mirrors games. This is how the world community knew that it was clear that they were in violation of international law. And this is, once again, this wasn't a snippet of what was presented by Negroponte. This was the complete text. You heard exactly what was submitted to the UN Security Council. Now, he also goes into, on paragraph 33 of Resolution 687, that states that the Security Council, quote, declares that upon official notification by Iraq to the Security General and to the Security Council of its acceptance of the provisions above, a formal ceasefire is effected between Iraq and Kuwait and the member states cooperating with Kuwait in accordance with Resolution 678, unquote. Now, it's important to note that Iraq did actually notify Security Council, the Security General Council, in May of 1991, that it intended to abide by the obligations in 687. So the ceasefire went into effect. So them using these types of things is basically a smoke and mirrors game. Negroponte's conclusion about Sam, quote, the United States, quote, are taking, quote, necessary steps to defend the United States and the international community from the threat posed by Iraq to restore international peace and security in the area, unquote. Once again, there's nothing that, there was no immediate threat by Saddam Hussein. As we know, there was no weapons of mass destruction found. Various other Security Council resolutions have showed that Iraq had been disarmed of its nuclear weapons program, its biological and chemical weapons program. The chemical and biological weapons only have a shelf life of 3 to 4 years under optimum situations. You know, now being in some unrefrigerated, you know, vault or hidden under the ground or under the airport and all this other hocus pocus stuff that Chalabi and these clowns were saying, it stands no chance of being able to sustain itself. So the Security Council had found that Iraq had been in compliance. This is why so much of the international community was in an uproar. And the United States government had to go through various forms of arm twisting, spying on other UN nations with Britain. You remember when they wiretapped the phones and all of that to see who was still trying to hold out? All this, Sam's the unlawful party. But you don't hear any of this type of challenge by the liberal, right? Craftsman on his little KQED. Now, next, let's go to Bill O'Reilly, you know, who's supposed to be on the opposite side offensive, Krasny, right? On his little radio show, describing how Saddam Hussein should be treated. And O'Reilly's four questions to Hussein, which he would expect to be answered. Check this out.
I give you the 4 points. I want to point out that already the International Red Cross and Human Rights Watch, two very left-wing organizations, are saying
You have to be nice to him. You have to be nice. We want to see him. Make sure that he gets all the amenities. Cable. Godiva's. Massage. Acupuncture if he needs it. You know, I mean, they couldn't even wait 24 hours before these people started with this.
We'll give him a little acupuncture.
Yeah, I'd give him some acupuncture. All right, now, look, these are the four questions that he has to answer, Saddam has to answer before there's any trial. All right? Now, my idea is to let Dan Rather go over and interrogate him.
Rather. Uh-huh.
That's a joke. I'm just kidding. I actually stuck up for Rather. All right, that's not going to happen.
On the show, I didn't see.
Yeah, you don't see anything. Here are the four questions. One. Where are the weapons of mass destruction? You had them unless the Kurds faked their own deaths. Pretty much the left-wing websites are even saying that. The left-wing websites, if you really want a real chuckle today, ladies and gentlemen, go to the left-wing websites. They are hysterical. Bill Moyers can't come out of the house. He can't. You can see his nose pressed up against the window pane inside his house. He can't come out. He's so vaclet, okay? He is just beside himself that this happened. The left-wing website, you know what their mantra is today?
What?
Here's how absurd this is. They say, well, if you're gonna prosecute Saddam, you have to prosecute George Bush the Elder, because he was an ally. We have to prosecute all the American presidents because they helped Saddam in the 80s against Iran. This is what the pathetic, dishonest left-wing websites are doing. And if you guys are going on there, I can't tell you. Just work with the homeless, help somebody, why are you just, a mind is a terrible thing to waste, all right? Yes, and off the right-wing websites, I don't even want to get into them, since they're mad at me because I don't want people to have assault weapons, okay? I don't think that's a good thing for society. Oh, they're going crazy. So, all right, you guys go crazy, all right? Pistol, fine. Hunting rifle, fine. Protect your family all day long. Big bear in the backyard, shoot him in the head. Okay?
Yeah, home is not a home.
You don't need an assault weapon, all right? And if you do need it, let me know why, and then I'll solve that problem in your community. Okay? If there are a bunch of Iraqi terrorists living adjacent to you, we want to know. The factor will help. All right? All right, but let's get back. The loony left-wing people, they just drive me nuts. Okay, look. Here are the four things that we have to get. If we have to pull his fingernails out, hey, you know, life is short. Where are the weapons of mass destruction that you killed the Kurds with? Where are they? Two, did you bribe foreign leaders to support you? And who gave you arms violating the UN embargo? You think there's not a lot of foreign leaders in Europe and Russia sweating right now? Ho-ho. We have information that huge amounts of money, cash, were sent to some of these people by Saddam and his emissaries. Actually, talked to a guy, he said that he saw that, he witnessed it. Don't have it nailed down yet, but it's not inconceivable. You got a $72 million slush fund. You're greasing these guys to help you out.
Even though France and Germany came out yesterday and said, oh, this is such a great thing.
They're delighted.
They're delighted
over there. I didn't know there was a word for delighted in German. Does anybody know the German word for delighted? I don't know. French, of course, delighted. All right, number three, which terrorist groups did Saddam directly support with money in safe harbor? We know Hamas, we know Hezbollah, and the others. And number four, what do you know about Al-Qaeda?
Mm-hmm.
Report in the British press over the weekend that says, and this is very interesting, that Abu Nidal, the big terrorist who was living in Baghdad before Saddam had him assassinated, all right, Saddam said he committed suicide. Four bullets in the head.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, I'd like to see that in
How
slow
do you do
motion.
That?
I'd like to see that. Four bullets in it. Anyway, the British press is reporting, and this supposedly comes from a captured document, that Abu Nidal trained Mohammed Atta, the lead 9/11 hijacker, in Baghdad. That blows all Al-Qaeda. If that can be proven, all right, and again, this is a report from the British press based upon a document they say they've seen. We have not seen it. We don't know whether it's true, but if it is, it's all over for every Democratic candidate except Gebhardt and Lieberman. They're the only two who supported the action, all right? So all the others, if Bush can get a hold of his document, he ought to just hold it up. And that's it for the others. They're done. They're through. So those four questions. Where are the weapons of mass destruction? Did you bribe foreign leaders to support you? Which terrorist groups did you support with money in safe harbor? And what do you know about Al-Qaeda? And you got to load them up with sodium pentothal. You got everything. You got to have them on the lie detector thing. And you got to do all of that. And, you know, look, I play them rap music 24 hours a day. That's how I break them. Mm-hmm. I would. Ludacris. All right, the hose. There's a hoe in a hole. And I just keep playing it and deprive them of sleep. I'm serious here. No sleep.
Right.
And bang them, bang them, bang them. And you answer those questions, and then you'll get your massage. Okay? You got to get the stuff. You got to get it. I mean, this is not playing anymore. Okay? This is, we have to get this. And you hand them over to the Egyptians. They know how to do it.
All right. So basically, while O'Reilly is more bombastic and probably grates the average liberal slash progressive type more because of the way he, you know, talks about pulling out his fingernails and giving them over to the Egyptians, he's just more crude. Fundamentally, there, once again, you have an acceptance by O'Reilly to Krasny over the legitimacy, quote unquote, of the U.S. being over there in the first place, setting the mandate, setting the tone, setting the agenda for the Iraqi people and their future. In other words, there is no challenge whatsoever to empire. None from either of them. Now, of course, while O'Reilly likes to pose as like a free thinker, most people know that he's not a challenger to empire. But Krasny has more or less a little bit of an image that at least is presented as someone more concerned about the possible abuses. But there is no concern. It's all about empire. Now, O'Reilly goes off with the typical rhetoric about where are the weapons of mass destruction, unless the Kurds fake their death and all of that type of stuff. Well, the Kurdish death was during the time of, as most know, of the U.S. alliance with them, with Saddam. Now, as far as weapons of mass destruction, well, here's some of the corporations that have been engaged with supplying Saddam with weapons of mass destruction. Let's take the rocket missile program, Honeywell. Spectrophysics gave not only conventional weapons, but military logistics supplies at the Iraqi Defense Ministry in building a military plant. You have, how about TI Coating, another U.S. corporation, nuclear program. UNIS, the nuclear program and conventional weapons and military logistics. You got Tektronix, rocket missile program, and the conventional, they were involved in the rocket missile program and the nuclear program. So the nuclear program and how to deliver them is where Tektronix fell in. Layboard Vacuum Systems, nuclear program. Finnegan, Matt U.S., nuclear program. Hewlett Packard, nuclear program. Rocket missile program. Conventional weapons program. DuPont, nuclear program. Eastman Kodak, the rocket missile program. Acolyte International, chemical weapons program. Consarik, nuclear program. Cerberus LTD, nuclear program. Axel Electronics, nuclear program. Canberra Industries, nuclear program. International Computer Systems, nuclear program. Rocket missile program. Conventional weapons program. So who are these fools trying to kid when you got all of these U.S. Corporations knee-deep in chemical, biological, and nuclear program, weapons of mass destruction to Saddam, and you got the Bill O'Reillys of the world, one in the front, and start on another page as if there is some legitimacy to the role of the U.S. Empire. Now, also one has to think, when O'Reilly, you know, talks all this stuff about if we have to pull his fingernails out and all of that type of stuff, and just imagine if some top-ranking U.S. official, Rumsfeld, Cheney, Colin Powell, Condoleezza Rice, Boy George himself, had been captured. There would be screams and calls for quote-unquote fair treatment of these captured individuals and the throwing up of international law if they violated them. But here, they have no pretense, neither one, of violating a Saddam Hussein's prisoner of war status. So let's now go back to Krasny, who now asks Williamson Murray, what does Saddam Hussein's capture mean? So let's see how Krasny explores this on this KQED program. We'll take it from there. Check this out.
Well, Williamson Murray, welcome. Let me say officially glad to have you here, and thank you for joining us.
Delighted to be here.
What does this mean as you see it, this capture?
Well, I think there are a couple factors that are crucial here. One is that there have been a substantial number of people, particularly in the center of Iraq, who've been sitting on the fence post, really worried that Saddam was going to come back. That one fashion or another, we were going to leave too early the way we did. And even some of the Shiites may have felt this. We were going to leave the way we did in 1991 before things had been cleaned up. Now that he's in our hands and clearly going to be tried, and my guess is that particularly if the new government of Iraq tries him, they will make sure that he is removed from the land of the living very quickly, because he's too much of a political danger. You would not want to have him still around alive, still encouraging people just by his presence, or discouraging people.
I guess it's hard for us to believe that there's so many Baptists who are loyal to him.
I think both that and I think in terms of, we have to remember the nightmare of his rule. It's sort of as if Adolf Hitler had survived the Second World War. People, the depth of fear of Saddam Hussein and his capacity to reach out and kill almost anybody in Iraqi society has not gone away, and it will not go away until he's dead.
Is this going to affect, from a military historian standpoint, can you see this really affecting this, what's being described as the insurgency?
I think to a certain extent it will. I think that it will make a number of Iraqis who've been sitting on the fence, worried about what's going to happen in the long term, come down off the fence and participate or support, if you will, the coalition and the whatever emerging kind of government takes over. But again, I think we've got to understand that about 75% of Iraq is in pretty good condition right now. That it's really the Sunni triangle that we're running into difficulties with, and there it's crucial that people come down on. On the other hand, there are a number of Baathist supporters and officials and ideologues who are not going to be affected by Saddam's capture and eventual execution.
They're still going to be opposed to occupation, as they see it.
Just simply flat out opposed. And then, of course, we've got the Al-Qaeda problem. They are clearly a large number of crazies are coming into the country and participating. But in fact, the most effective resistance is being done by people who, my guess is, were middle-level Baathist or perhaps even sort of brigadier generals in the secret police who have real contacts throughout the country. And they're doing a pretty effective job.
All right, now, what's also fascinating about this last piece was... this Williamson Murray, this has been spouting off the typical type of cliche-ish things about who's actually resisting in Iraq right now. Now, and had the nerve to say that people have been sitting on the fence, worried about Saddam Hussein maybe coming back to power, as if these people would now just fall in line and think now it's safe to bow down to Sam, because Saddam is gone for good. Now, all types of independent on-the-ground reporting have been showing that the masses of people who are resisting are not resisting in the name of Saddam Hussein, but are resisting in the name of occupation. You recently had Robert Fisk, who has looked into a number of these units of resistance. And of the 12, only one he found had any kind of connection to the Ba'athist regime. The rest were a variety of, you know, from nationalists to kind of, religious sectarian types. People don't like to be occupied. And all honest reports that have come from the ground, where independent reporters have gone there, have seen that this is much more organic than what these shysters like Murray have been trying to portray. But see, he's a spin doctor, and he's not interested in trying to parlay the truth, not even for the empire's own good and understanding. And Krasny is just a go-along, so he just bobs his head to it. And by doing so, plays a role in disinforming his own listeners. Even though he's supposed to have an image that is, supposed to be on the opposite end and more inquiring. And, you know, it's all image. It's all smoke and mirrors. It's just posturing. So this Murray guy comments how one would think that they would want to remove Saddam from the land of the living very quickly, so on and so forth. The reason why many who are part of the status quo of the U.S. empire would want to do that is they just don't want him talking. They don't want him to reveal the long and historical connections. They don't even want any form of a fair trial, because they know some of the things and facts and people who could be called on the witness stand who would have to reveal some very embarrassing points of history. So fundamentally, from Krasny to Bill O'Reilly, while O'Reilly, as I said before, is more bombastic, you basically have a situation where there is no fundamental difference. Now, let's go back to O'Reilly, who's Krasny's counterpart in reality, as he talks to a caller from, on his show, who yaps about the variety of topics one can bring up on the issue of Saddam's capture. And then goes into the caller, and they take it one more step within the shadows. Check this out.
1-877-9, those spin lines are popping here. Now, look, there's a whole bunch of different facets on this. There's the election, there's a foreign policy, there's a BillO'Reilly.com poll question, where should Saddam be tried, USA, Iraq, or The Hague, all of that. So we'll take all those questions and any impressions you have on the situation. Let's go to West Hartford, Connecticut, where Joe is in the no-spin zone. What say you, Joe?
Hi, Bill. Just finished reading your first two books, and I enjoyed them.
Thank you, Joe. I appreciate that.
I was going to make the point here about, you said, the Red Cross making sure that Saddam is being treated nicely.
Right.
I expect to see the ACLU weigh in anymore.
They can.
You know, if people would care for those who are hurt as much as those who do the hurting, we'd be a lot better off.
No, that's for sure. We have to have advocates for those who are incarcerated. We do. But these people, they don't even give you breathing room.
Think of that lieutenant colonel there. That they fine for $5,000 and they're kicking him up because he shot a gun near somebody's head.
Yeah, they're not kicking him out. He's leaving on his own volition. But we got him justice. He's going to get his full pension. But look, I'm with you, Joe. I mean, these people are professional. What they are, professional whiners on behalf of a clientele that we all admit should have representation, but give it a rest. Give it a rest. You know, we got more important things to do than worry about if this guy's going to have, what he's going to have for lunch right now. if it was me, he's not having lunch. You know what I'm talking about here?
Yeah,
he's not having lunch.
Kill him with kindness, though. Give him all these rice, and then the whole world will see that we are staying true to what we say. We're staying true to our beliefs, and, you know, then convict him in a court of law.
You're a loon. You really are a certifiable loon. You
what
really
idea?
Are. We need to find out where anthrax is and
Fine.
Gas is. Kill him with kindness?
But,
yeah, all right. Just give me him. Look, I know guys in Levittown, okay? Give me him for 2 days. Just that's all I want.
Okay, so basically you just hear the bombastic thuggery of O'Reilly. All of this type of stuff about we need to find out where anthrax is. There is no facts anywhere near that there's anthrax any place around. How about finding the anthrax that was sent to various U.S. officials and that came from some institutions in the U.S. as they checked out the genes of the anthrax. So they know it was made here. It was some clown in the U.S. How about finding out that anthrax? Where it came from? Who sent it in this country? But all this bombastic talk. And see, that's often the smoke and mirror stuff that gets people to think that O'Reilly is all that much different than Krasny. O'Reilly is just a showman, a loud mouth. You know, he tries to play the little macho role. You know, I know some people from some little punk ass area that I guess is supposed to be hardcore, you know. He's going to send them there and they'll straight. That's just all bombastic talk. O'Reilly showed that he was a little punk when he let Terry Gross, a pimp slap him and he ran out of her show crying. Now, if you can't take, Terry Gross's show because she asked you a few questions that got under your skin and you, quit and go running out, don't talk about how you could pimp slap, Saddam Hussein around. You can't take on this little, liberal slash pseudo-progressive activist on her little show. So please, O'Reilly, quit fronting. But what's also fascinating is him and the caller mentioned about how he was upset about how this one prisoner, they were upset because a colonel got discharged because he shot a gun by the head of this prisoner. Well, what happened was, it's true that the U.S., captured some guy. Whether this guy was a true resistance fighter or not, who knows within the way the U.S. empire operates. Look at Guantanamo. You know, all the people that they've just rounded up. But look at the 5,000-plus people that they've gathered up under, you know, the whole Ashcroft mechanism of Arabs, Muslims, South Asians. It was just a broad safety net. And many of them have been shown not to have any kind of connection to any kind of opposition force to the U.S. empire. So the U.S. hands being clean on these issues has historically been bloody. But what ended up happening is they had captured some guy, and then the colonel had his soldiers beat the guy up. And then he shot the gun later by the guy's ear. And it was one of his own soldiers who had been witnessing all this brutality that turned him in. And this is how the ball started rolling. They basically ended up letting him off. Kind of, you know, letting him resign or whatever instead of getting dishonorably discharged. My whole point is that the caller brings it up half-cocked. And then O'Reilly does not clarify what really happened. And then they just go on about their bickering. And basically the whole thrust of it is that, look, the U.S. empire needs to get tough on these terrorists. And the sky's the limit on what you should do. Now, this is a double standard because they've always claimed that anyone who captures a little U.S. G.I. Joe, they rush out there talking about they are supposed to follow the Geneva Convention properly. They were even saying that about the Iraqi fighters, about them wearing the proper uniform. They were complaining early when the U.S. Came in and bombarded the Iraqis that the many Iraqis weren't wearing proper military uniform. So if you got the nerve to cry about someone not having proper military uniform, and then at the same time you're torturing and beating up their people, you got something a screw loose, which is, well, exactly what he does have. Now next, what's another thing I wanted to bring up that O'Reilly mentioned. And I kind of tie it in. And he brought this up before on the excerpt that I had played beforehand, was how he tries to pose himself as someone on, this down the road common sense, and how the right wings don't like him because he's against having assault weapons. I think it's pretty clear now what's happening, because first of all, O'Reilly's a right winger. And O'Reilly is against assault weapons. You've seen many corporations come out against assault weapons and guns in general in the U.S. And you've seen, of course, their liberal counterparts against all forms of assault weapons, etc. And recently the Supreme Court backed up California's ban on assault weapons, which basically nowadays means guns that take a detachable clip. It's not like if an assault weapon that are sold in America are automatic weapons. Assault weapons in America are defined now by weapons that have a detachable clip. You still have to pull the trigger each time for the bullet to shoot, so it doesn't just repeat a shot out. My whole point in mentioning this is that we all know that the Supreme Court is a right-wing reactionary court. We know Bill O'Reilly is reactionary. So why are these right-wingers against good old civilians having assault weapons, i.e. Weapons that take a detachable clip? And that's because they don't really want the citizens armed any more than they want the Iraqis armed. Because they know how things are going to look in the future. And they know that in the same way that people, an armed populace with some consciousness, can cause havoc on occupational forces and forces that are trying to deprive you of your rights and set the agenda, can have a hell of a time by an armed and motivated populace. It's not that an armed populace, quote unquote, overthrows the government itself. But it's one thing to make an army, an occupying army, bleed a little bit. It's another thing when they have 1,000 cuts. It's another thing when they have 1,000,000 cuts. It's not that you topple their tanks or anything. So get what I'm saying. Here you have O'Reilly against assault weapons in U.S. citizens' hands. Now, one would expect with the image of O'Reilly that he would be saying, arm the U.S. citizens to the teeth. We got to fight these terrorists. And if a terrorist shows his head up, shows his head, blow it off. That's your patriotic duty. But he knows that there is no real war on terrorism. There's a war on us, the masses of people. And us, whether you are a southerner in the Sudan, or a Palestinian, or an Iraqi, or yes, a U.S. citizen that's being negrofied and having your rights negrofied, you too need gun control. That's the real program of the rights, of the right wing, and of this right wing activist court. Now, next, let's hear from Francis Boyle. He's a professor of international law at Illinois. Talk on the Third Geneva Convention and the rights granted to prisoners of war, which is what Saddam Hussein is. Now, this is the type of person you don't hear on Bill O'Reilly's show, but you also don't hear on Krasny's show, because at the end of the day, they're on the same side, trying to project and maintain the same status quo agenda. So let's check out what this professor has to lay down. Dig this.
So even the International Committee of the Red Cross has just publicly stated that Saddam Hussein on television violates Article 13 and Article 14 of the Third Geneva Convention. Article 13 says, quote, prisoners of war must at all times be humanely treated. In particular, no prisoner of war may be subjected to physical mutilation or medical or scientific experiments of any kind, etc., etc. Prisoners of war must at all times be protected, particularly against acts of violence or intimidation, and against insults and public curiosity. Article 14, prisoners of war are entitled in all circumstances to respect for their persons and their honor. Certainly, when this type of treatment, public humiliation was inflicted on United States Armed Forces by Iraq, we correctly took the position that this was a war crime and that we would prosecute the people who were responsible for it. What is sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander. The same principle of law applies here. If they had just shown the mugshot where his beard had been shaved and looked like the Saddam Hussein we all know, I don't believe that would have qualified as a violation of Article 13 and Article 14. But clearly the video of the medical exam was designed to humiliate the man in the eyes of the entire world. Despite what Rumsfeld said, there is no basis whatsoever to disqualify him as a prisoner of war. In the event that he is prosecuted for war crimes, he maintains his status as a prisoner of war throughout the prosecution. Again, that principle was well established even here in the United States in federal district court with respect to Manuel Noriega, pursuant to the rulings by Judge Hoover down in Florida, and those rulings were correct. So this implication by Rumsfeld that somehow, for some reason, we might deprive him of his POW status would, if acted upon, constitute a grave breach of the Third Geneva Convention. I don't see how he's going to get a fair trial in Iraq at all. Under the laws of war, the so-called Coalition Provisional Authority set up by Bremer is nothing more than a puppet government in accordance with U.S. Army Field Manual 2710 of 1956, the laws of land warfare. The laws of war do not prohibit setting up a puppet government if that's what we want to do. However, it still remains a puppet government, and we are fully responsible for whatever the puppet government does. Here, the puppet government has set up an ad hoc war crimes tribunal that was drafted by the by the Pentagon. The problem with that is that the Hague regulations and U.S. Army Field Manual 27-10 make it quite clear that the belligerent occupant, namely the United States government, cannot alter the domestic legal regime or the municipal courts or constitution of an occupied state. They remain intact pending the occupation. So these are going to be nothing more than puppet kangaroo courts. The fix is already in. Bush already said today, I guess in his interview on ABC News, that Saddam Hussein should be executed. It's on the wire services today that one of the members of this puppet government has already said the day we get our so-called sovereignty, we'll put him on trial and we'll execute him the next day. So this is a joke and a fraud. It's going to be pretty much like the kangaroo court operation down in Guantanamo. And there's a very good reason, of course, why the Bush people want to do this and not transfer him to some type of international tribunal. Because if they transfer him to an international tribunal for prosecution, then of course he would be able to bring out in his defense the complicity and aiding and abetting by the United States government going back to the so-called liberal Carter administration and Zbigniew Brzezinski, who engineered the so-called tilt toward Iraq, and running up through Reagan and Bush Sr. for his crimes against Iran, the Iran-Iraq war, and everything else. Providing biological weapons, chemical weapons, components for nuclear weapons. So it seems to me they're certainly not going to want some type of free, fair trial that clearly would be required by the Third Geneva Convention to prosecute him. They want a show trial where the fix is in, which it already is in. They're going to control who the lawyers are, who the judges are, what the evidence is, what the news media is. Again, pretty much like what we're seeing down in Guantanamo today with the kangaroo courts, only instead of doing it by themselves, they'll use the puppet government set up by Paul Bremer and his proxies.
And Boyle hit on something when he said about, who the people in charge of the trial will be, what news gets out, and so on and so forth. Because in many ways, while they'll help it, they'll help establish the same type of status quo media organizations, committees, and fronts in Iraq, which they're already starting to do so, that you see here in America, where you see from Crossfire, where one fool is supposed to be on the left, and then, you know, you got some right-wing hack, when in reality you got basically a right centrist and a far-right person. So you have two right-wing people posturing and putting on a minstrel show like they're in opposition. And the only time bullets really hit each other is from friendly fire. Now, this is outside of them having special guests on from time to time, like Al Franken or Jeannie Garofalo. But for the most part, it's just two right-wing hacks, or centrists at very best, which is no good at all, and the typical right-winger like Robert Novak. As you can see, when you see Krasny and both O'Reilly go on and on with this complete acceptance of what the U.S. is doing without bringing up some of the issues that Boyle has brought up, and then it's just more or less posed by O'Reilly that any type of concept that the United States be anything but an international lawless criminal that he is, then that's posed by O'Reilly as being soft. Now Krasny just accepts it, you know, as you heard. He didn't challenge anything concerning the U.S. Position and role in setting up these types of things. Now, what's also fascinating was that the U.S. actually drafted the Third Geneva Convention after World War II. Roosevelt insisted upon it. So here you have the U.S. Empire being involved in drafting the Third Geneva Convention. And then, 50 years later, 60 years later, they're basically ignoring everything in sight and just running straight ahead, because the reality is that the U.S. Empire sees that it has more room and flexibility to flex its imperial might now than it had right after World War II. That's the difference. It's not that the imperialists are any different. It's that they are conscious of the world situations and surrounding. And with the deterioration of the Soviet Union and other power plays that have shifted more into their favor, well, now they're just running amok. Now next, let's go back to Krasny as he goes into with his guest about how the early stages of the U.S. invasion were actually spectacular displays of the U.S. military power. So let's check this out.
The one thing that certainly stands out in your book is that the military, putting intelligence aside, just the military effort of that three-week war was extraordinary in terms of bringing different services together, in terms of bringing and integrating, really, the technology, the new technology you alluded to in all this military. Of course, the firefights were much more profound than we perhaps realized in the States, and there were all kinds of things and nuances that you touched on, but for the most part, this was really quite an extraordinary campaign.
Yeah.
Militarily.
Yeah, in straight military terms, from March 20th through 15th of April, is probably the best campaign waged by the American military since the campaigns of 1945 in Germany. And not only that, what is clear is the capacity of the services to work together, including, and I would say particularly the Marines and the Army, work together in an extraordinary fashion. The operational level of war, this was a much better show than the 1991 Gulf War, which got a huge amount of attention, and I think unjustifiable praise initially, although there was a series of books that then appeared 3 or 4 years later that really indicated substantial problems.
Now, the reason why I played this shows you how sick Krasny really is. I mean, he's basically getting into this like a cheerleading aspect. You know, without a devoid of any form of justification, which there is none, as if we're supposed to get into some kind of patriotic flag waving about how well the U.S. imperial machine first smashed its way in, as if you have a bunch of Nazis bragging about how well they blitzed their way into France and with their military prowess, as if that in itself is some kind of great feat. Now, with the U.S. Blasting into Iraq, it's even more cowardly because you have a situation where Iraq went through over a decade of sanctions. Its population pulverized. Well over a million people evaporated by all of the sanctions and stuff. The skyrocketing of all types of diseases because of the various sanctions on medical supplies and things like that. The disarmament of Iraq's more powerful weapons to defend itself. And then when it's basically on its knees, the empire comes stomping in. And these two fools want to talk about it as if some kind of great military prowess and expertise. They didn't even have a damn airplane in the sky, talking about Iraq, to be able to defend themselves. While the U.S. had planes, ships, all types of satellites, navigational tools. It was even using animals, dolphins and stuff. Had chickens and stuff over there as part of their slave military machinery. And this is how sick the real Krasny and these types of liberal shows are. Now here's O'Reilly yapping on how he would personally break Saddam Hussein. Yeah, check this out.
But we need to know who he bribed and all of that. But let me submit this to you, Flora. Now that you're a premium member from BillO'Reilly.com, you'll be dealing with these questions every day when you go on the website. Here's what I would do. Very micro. Don't tell the International Red Cross, okay? Please don't tell them. I get him in. And right now, well, I figure he's on some aircraft carrier somewhere in the Gulf. Right? I mean, off gutter or someplace like that. And we put him in a small room. For 2 days, nobody talks to him. Nobody sees him. All right? He just sits there for 2 days. Get a little water, a little bread. Weaken him. Okay? Then you go in and you lay it out on the line. I go in. I'll go over. All right? I said, look, it's over for you. You're either a dead man or you're going to sit in a dungeon for the rest of your life. That's it. Okay? Now, if you cooperate with us, we'll make it as your remaining days on this planet as pleasurable as possible. You know, we'll get decent food and you'll get to read some stuff and we'll have a conversation every day. All right? Maybe I'll even give you a little exercise. Maybe I'll let you out and you can see the sun. Okay? If you don't, here's what's going to happen. Okay? we are going to pipe in ludicrous rap music. And I would use that because that's the worst stuff on earth. All right? 24 hours a day, you're going to get that piped into this little room, which means you're not going to be able to sleep. And if you do happen to fall asleep, then we're going to come in and wake you up. All right? You're not going to get anything to eat except this soggy bread and this water, and we'll give you vitamin shots to keep you alive, hypodermic shots. All right? But you're not going to get anything that tastes. You're not going to have any food to taste. No reading material. Nothing. No conversation with anybody. Now, we're going to keep that up for as long as you want to play this game. Then I would see how he reacted to that. If he still we weren't getting anywhere after a week, I'd give him, a week or so. Then I load him up on sodium pentothal. Strap him down, bang, 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 bang. Try to go that way. Because I think he's a coward, see? Mm-hmm. I see him as a coward. I don't see him as a macho man at all. If you're a macho man, he would have killed himself. You know what they were looking for in his mouth? They were looking for a capsule. They were looking for the cyanide capsule. That's what the guy was looking for. They weren't looking for his, leeches in there or roaches. They were looking for a cyanide capsule. This guy, he's not macho. Look, Uday and Kruse went out shooting. Okay? This guy, he's in the dirt like a worm. You can break him.
See, O'Reilly just be talking smack. I mean, here's a little... What could possibly break him is pump a O'Reilly show into him 24 hours a day without a chance of you being able to get your hands on O'Reilly to break his little punk neck. Now that can drive someone crazy. Hearing some little twig like him talk smack 24 hours a day like he's some John Wayne who is also a buster. That in itself can drive you crazy. But hearing O'Reilly talk his little cowboy-like smack kind of helps clarify what would drive people to fly planes into buildings in the U.S. Because he makes it so clear the arrogance and lawlessness of so many people within the American populace. Don't tell the International Red Cross. A little bread and water to weaken them. Sodium pentothal. All of this type of stuff, which is clearly in violation of international law. But see, when Sam has to get the job done, Sam justifies it because being a lawless empire, you'll go ahead and justify the invasion into Panama, the violent, bloody coup action in Haiti, the attempted coup in Venezuela, and on and on and on and on. Now that's the coward, along with O'Reilly. But to wrap this up, let's go into Andreas Zuma. He's the UN correspondent for the German newspaper Takahashi. On a 12,000-page report, Iraq actually turned over to the UN concerning who provided them chemical, nuclear, and biological material goods. Now, O'Reilly's fronting, and so was Krasny about getting this type of information out. But let's go back, because at one time, the Iraqi government did give documents over who had provided them these biological, chemical, and nuclear weapons arsenal. So let's find out from Andreas Zuma what actually happened to the documents when they were turned over to the UN. Check this out.
Well, the U.S. stole it after its arrival in New York. They took it down to Washington under the pretension that only in Washington you had decent copy machines to make copies for the other members of the council, but what came back to New York a few days later was only a 3,000-page version, and this is all what the 10 non-permanent members of the council ever got. Only the 5 permanent members, US, Russia, Great Britain, France, and China, till today have the 12,000 pages, and in the short version, the 3,000 pages, you have no mentioning of all the far-reaching complicity the US, Germany, France, Britain, Soviet Union, and to a lesser degree, China, are guilty of during the last 30 years, complicity with the regime of Saddam Hussein, a point Francis Boyle already pointed out.
So now that helps kind of close out why these two hacks and status quo talking heads for and in the defense of the U.S. empire do not have a problem with the U.S. Ramroading this kind of fake regime into place, having the trial within the umbrella of the U.S. empire and under the control, and basically whatever and however the U.S. wants to dispose of Saddam at the end of the day, it's A-OK for both Krasny and O'Reilly, because they're both spokesmen for the U.S. empire, and they know that the truth lurks beyond the shadows where they lurk in, which is something and somewhere that both of them truly hide in. The shadows. Hold on a sec.
Actually in worse shape than the one that they hadn't quote-unquote rebuilt yet. They had put in fans instead of air conditioners. They had, they didn't have light bulbs for the school. They had used a subcontractor to do sort of this slapdash job so that they could check off on the list that they had quote-unquote rebuilt these schools. So even though they're charging very high prices for these things in these rebuilding budgets, the quality of the work is a open scandal, and I think we're going to learn a lot more about this as independent journalists and others start going over there, and as Iraqis get to speak out about what's happening. Because another thing that we've learned is in things like the work on the power system at the biggest power plant for Baghdad, there's Iraqi engineers who have been telling anybody who will listen that they can do the job better than groups like Bechtel and Halliburton. If they just had tools, the spare parts, they could do it cheaper, they could do it more effectively. They kept it together through years and years of sanctions and war, but they're not being allowed to do the job. And so you've got U.S. companies charging tremendous profit margins and overhead, and a lot of times not showing up for work because of the security situation. We just had a situation where some South Korean engineers who were subcontractors to the Washington Group, which is a big U.S. construction firm, actually left the country because they sent a couple of their colleagues out into a very dangerous zone where the U.S. had just claimed to have killed a bunch of quote-unquote Fedayeen guerrillas loyal to Saddam. They sent them through that area with no bodyguards, with no protective gear, just basically an SUV with a driver. Two of them were killed immediately, two of them were wounded. These engineers, about 60 of them, basically rebelled against their supervisors, said, you know, we want out of here, and they got one-way tickets back to Seoul. So, you know, a lot of these folks are probably being paid big money to sit in hotels in Kuwait. It's not even clear that a lot of this work is proceeding at any kind of significant pace, and a lot of the dirty work is being done by first-tier and second-tier foreign workers, subcontractors who are taking the brunt of the risks in what is, in many cases, are very difficult and insecure circumstances. So the Bush administration, which claims to be trying to let democracy flower in Iraq, let Iraq be for the Iraqis, mostly is lining the pockets of companies like Halliburton, Bechtel, DynCorp, which has been charged with trying to restructure the Iraqi justice system. When DynCorp worked in the Balkans, two of their employees were running a prostitution ring, basically selling Bosnian girls of teenage and preteen age into prostitution. And the only reason that was found out about is because a couple of other employees at DynCorp reported that. And the employees who reported it were fired by DynCorp. And the employees who did the illegal activity were not fired. It was only after a civil suit was brought that those people were pulled out of the country, and they never were subjected to criminal charges. So a company with that kind of track record in the Balkans has now got a big fat contract to restructure the Iraqi justice system. So these are the kinds of companies that are on the receiving end of these billions and billions of dollars of U.S. tax money to create the new, quote-unquote, new Iraq. There's a lot of international lawyers have questioned whether, in the absence of a legitimate government under a position of occupation, whether things like the foreign investment law that was rammed through that allows companies to own up to 100% of any sector other than energy, whether that, in fact, is valid under international law, and whether those contracts would be have to be really accepted or recognized once a legitimate government takes power. Mark Feynman, a very good reporter for the Los Angeles Times, who unfortunately died of a heart attack while in Iraq covering these very issues, one of the last articles that he wrote before he died was about the new investment law. And he interviewed some Iraqi entrepreneurs who were trying to get businesses started in the post-Saddam period. And when this law came through, they said, well, what are we supposed to do here? I mean, you're telling us that you want, you know, entrepreneurs, you want new businesses in Iraq, you want a free market in Iraq, and then now you're telling us we have to compete against multinational corporations from day one. That makes no sense. I mean, you have to give us some room to build indigenous businesses here in Iraq. You can't from day one say some company can come in and, you know, buy up huge sectors of Iraqi banking, Iraqi mercantile activity, and so forth. And originally, they claimed that they were not going to do this. And they said, oh, no, we would never, you know, move ahead with anything like this until there's a legitimate government in place. But basically, the U.S. occupying authority just changed their minds. They panicked. They decided they weren't getting leverage. They weren't getting enough international financial support. They decided to just speed up their timetable for doing things that originally they claimed they wouldn't do until there was internationally recognized government. And so there's a real question, you know, whether these contracts, whether a lot of these long-term deals that they've talked about putting in place with international companies really are going to be legitimate. And if we get to the point where there's an Iraqi government that is recognized internationally, and they have basically auctioned off large parts of Iraq's economy, have tied up the education system, basic structures of how the Iraqi economy is going to be run in long-term contracts with foreign companies, what exactly is going to be left for that government to decide? I mean, if their entire structure of their economy has already been decided by the U.S. occupying authority and these multinational companies, what is left for a government of the Iraqi people to decide about the future of their country if their entire economic structure of their society has been imposed on them from the outside? And not to mention, you know, there's companies like Research Triangle Institute and Creative Associates that are now, as we speak, writing the new curriculum for Iraq. So there's outside companies, you know, foreign companies deciding what should be the content of the curriculum for the textbooks for the children of Iraq and things like that, which, you know, I'm sure they could use a change from whatever Saddam was pouring down their throats, but it would be nice if you're talking about Iraq for the Iraqis, you know, wouldn't it be nice if some Iraqis would decide what the content of the curriculum of the schools in Iraq would be? I think that would be a refreshing change. And a lot of the, you know, the mechanisms for what they're calling consultation, be it the Iraqi Governing Council, be it these neighborhood councils, have been heavily rigged in favor of individuals who have close ties to Wolfowitz, the neocons, people like Ahmed Chalabi. His nephew is going to be running a tribunal that's supposed to try people for war crimes. And groups like Human Rights Watch and others have severe questions about whether this is just going to turn into a little power base for the Chalabi group to settle scores with people that they don't like. Because after all, Chalabi has been in the country for 45 years. So his ability to preside over an objective process of, you know, who should be tried for war crimes and who should be held to account, given the, you know, his own checkered history, I think is, you know, highly dubious. So there's a lot of issues here. It's really not so much setting up a government as really just setting up a kind of a big cash machine to funnel money to U.S. companies, many of which then are big donors, of course, to Bush-Cheney 2004. And so I think the whole thing just reeks of corruption and cronyism. And I think, you know, at a minimum, there should be a demand that none of these companies be allowed to give money to candidates in the 2004 elections, because it's just unbelievable that they're basically just funneling money, you know, out of the rebuilding of Iraq and putting it straight into, you know, the coffers of Bush's re-election campaign. And you have guys like Joe Albaugh, who was Bush's 2000 campaign manager, profiting off of this. You can't tell me that he's not steering these folks straight to the Bush-Cheney treasurer and say, oh, while you're at it, you know, why don't you just, you know, give a little thank you to the president and his entourage for me helping you get this contract. This is the way this stuff works.
So it's clear that as long as the U.S. empire is in existence and all its little Frankenstein-like monsters, we'll be doing everything but truly living. So from DynCorp and its slaves to the cronyism displayed by the capitalist corporations who now have their hooves and claws into the Iraqi people's soil, in vain for that matter, to the way the corporate media system runs, from Krasny to O'Reilly, it's clear that those who are within the ruling class circle and those who are supporters and defenders of it, we will not be doing anything that's close to living. And for us, it's truly time for living, because what we're under in this capitalist market system is everything but. Until the next time, slave revolt. Out.